Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we bring you our occasional series, Government from the Inside, and our focus this hour is San Francisco's Police Department. Joining me is San Francisco's Police Chief, Greg Suhr. When Mayor Ed Lee appointed him in 2011, Suhr enjoyed the support of the rank-and-file officers as well as the police union leadership. He's a fourth-generation San Franciscan and 30-year veteran of the force. Prior to being made chief, he had distinguished himself as captain of the Bayview District Station, where homicides dropped nearly 50% under his watch. Chief Suhr has championed initiatives more often the purview of social workers and nonprofits. One of his causes is the Police Foundation's Future Graduates Program, which gets companies to provide paid internships for at-risk youth. He's also pursued new technologies for the police department and recently announced the launch of the Field Reporting Mobile App, or BAT Computer, as he's dubbed it, which enables officers to access crime data and write reports remotely. Despite the stability Chief Suhr has brought to the force, 2012 saw an uptick in crime in San Francisco. According to department statistics, there were increases in crimes such as homicides, rapes, and domestic violence. Many of the crimes occurred in the Mission and Visitation Valley areas have been attributed to gangs, which are an ongoing problem for law enforcement in San Francisco. So tonight, Chief Suhr will discuss the challenges facing the police department, the new technologies he's implemented, and the ways the department engages with the communities it serves. So I want to welcome you, Chief Suhr.
Hi, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You can post a comment on our website at kalw.org, or you can go to our Facebook page. So, Chief Suhr, let's look back at 2012 and tell us how you saw the year in terms of crime statistics for the city of San Francisco.
Well, obviously, some of the things that you mentioned, obviously, homicides are up. We finished 2012 with 69 homicides. And I, like any chief, and certainly Mayor Lee, one homicide's too many. That said, it is the fourth best year we've had in the last 10 or 12. And gun violence, which I believe is the better measure of how we're doing, was actually down 3.5%. So even though we had more people pass from violence, we had less people shot in San Francisco. And in my mind, having worked the streets for a long time, any person that ever shoots anybody doesn't really mind if they kill them. So we need to continue to work on gun violence. Hmm. Property crime's up, as you say, about 10%. We're grappling with a little bit of this realignment that we're going on, where a lot of our less serious offenders were released from custody early. They were going to get out sooner or later, but when they were all released at once, almost 600 here in San Francisco, we, like all the other jurisdictions up and down the state, started seeing property crime tick up a little bit. So we're working real hard with adult probation, juvenile probation, and the district attorney's office to see what we can do to find the new normal on dealing with our nonviolent offenders.
Hmm. And have you been able to link that increase in the property crime rate to the folks that were released?
I mean, it seems to be the only anomaly that we can work with. And we have rearrested several guys that are what they call PRCS, pre-release custodies. And then, unfortunately, better than 50% of the folks that were released did have at least one act of violence or a gun in their priors before their nonviolent felony for which they were released. So I wouldn't say it's cause for concern, but it's something that we need to be paying attention to.
What other factors are you looking at as hypotheses for why the increase in homicides and other types of crime?
Well, the increase in homicides is actually pretty easy to explain. If you look at what we did when we had our record years of 2 years of 50 and 1 year of 44, this year we had, very sadly, we had the 5 homicides in one residence on Howth Street, and then we had the internal gang battle just over the hill here in the Visitation Valley. One gang got at themselves and ended up killing 10 of their compatriots in June. And then on the final weekend of July, we had the other end of the Visitation Valley gang get at themselves in one weekend, and 4 were killed. So when you look at those 19 homicides. It almost literally matches up exactly to what we were over from the years when we were, you know, being lauded almost nationally for our reduction in homicides.
Hmm. And then what do you attribute the decrease in gun violence to?
Well, I think the officers are very active. I think our strategy has been good. In August, we unveiled the Interrupt, Predict, and Organize strategy with the mayor's office, where we took measures to pretty much go after those most likely to either be victims and or suspects. And for the first time in 30 years, we had no homicides in the month of August at all, after a particularly violent June and a very violent final weekend in July. So I think that our engagement, our activity with young people has built trust within the community. We work very, very hard with all of our other partners in the city agencies outside of government. And you just can't get the job done without the help and trust of the community. If not to tell you who you should be looking at, but where you should be looking, so we can put the cops on the dots, if you will, so something doesn't happen.
So tell us a little bit more about this strategy that you implemented that led to this crime-free August, the homicide-free August. Tell us again, what was it called, and what was the actual part of the strategy?
The catchy part, it's IPO.
Mm-hmm.
So Interrupt, which is largely police department, which is trying to figure out those most likely to, which of our zone strategy, which has been in place under various titles all the way back into the 80s. But we very clearly delineate where the lion's share of our violence happens. We deploy our resources there. We survey who's in custody, who's out of custody, who's on probation, who we can pretty much see if we can save them from themselves, of either being the next suspect or the next victim. Parole searches, probation searches, whatever you can think of, and the kitchen sink gets thrown at it for the Interrupt part. And we do this from time to time whenever there's violence in the city, is we plug in basically the mini version of this to catch our breath through the weekend and then get back at it on the weekend to figure out what's going on to really interrupt it long term. Then the predict part, we're looking at new software. You talked about our new crime data warehouse that I have referred to as the Bat Computer. I'm dating myself, but to basically find out what are the patterns, what are the chances that if this happens there, that's going to happen there, and again, who's about to get out of custody, who are folks that have done crimes in the neighborhood before, what nonprofits and community-based organizations can we engage to talk about what's the temperature, what's our spider sense, what's our sense on the street telling us where something's going to jump off, and then we just put ourselves in it. And then the organized piece is the longer-term plan. I mean, we have enjoyed a good last 3 or 4 years as far as fatal gun violence goes. I mean, our average is in the low 50s now, where for 5 years it was close to 95 homicides a year. We need to keep this going and sustain it, and if you will, capitalize on this peace dividend right now to try and find a new normal. And that's what we're trying to do by engaging the kids with a better way to go.
Hmm. So let's go back to this and this Interrupt strategy. I'm very curious about this. So you're looking for people that are in custody, out of custody, on parole, people who are at risk. Is that where you're
sure
getting at? And then what do you do with that information?
Well, I mean, if we can, we'll take someone into custody. If I know that we've also gotten folks into employment, which at least gets them out of the mix during a regular period of the daytime and or nighttime. And then you got to rest if you're working. You and I will go to sleep at some point after mm-hmm. tonight's show. It's just we want to give people positive choices, positive avenues. And although it sounds very simple, if you put someone on the radar screen that, hey, we're looking at you, we're worried about you, you're someone who we're concerned with if something happens, usually it's sort of like when we were little kids and someone would say, hey, you know, Joseph, you run along right now, I'm going to tell your mom. Well, you don't want the cops, and my officers have just been terrific at making their presence felt in the neighborhoods, not just as an arresting or an occupying army, if you will, but somebody who people actually trust to give information to. I've often said I could care less if we get an arrest, but if somebody knows where a gun is, tell us. We'll go get the gun. And wouldn't it be great if somebody went to go get a gun to kill somebody and found the gun wasn't there anymore and was left to be disappointed?
So I think you hit on a very interesting question there, which is how, as a police chief, do you set a tone to, in the long haul, create a connection that sees the police presence as one of promoting safety and not of intrusion and not of, as you mentioned, occupation even.
Sure.
How do you think about that, and how do you turn that into the directives that you give your officers?
Well, I try to set the example myself. I'm somebody who's always willing to have the conversation with anybody about anything. There's no reason why the officer shouldn't be like that too. So, I mean, in my time in the police department, I worked in night watch in very busy stations. I worked in narcotics for a long time. I was on street crimes task forces. I worked some of the very busy stations, as you mentioned earlier. I did my time at Bayview, and I loved every single minute of every place I was at, not only for the cops, but for the people that I got to meet in the community. It's funny, we couldn't get into the radio station tonight, and I bumped into a lady that I worked with in the Bayview who had a sister she was picking up who my friend didn't know where the station was, but her sister did. And then we said, hey, we'll kind of see you down on 1800 Oakdale later on or something. So it goes a long way. It comes back around. And I think that the cops get it.
Yeah, we're in a hidden location here in lockdown. So, but you managed to find us. That's really great. So you're trying to set that tone of connection. So tell us a little bit about your force in terms of the demographics. Who makes up the force? Where do they come from? Where do they live? You know, tell us a little bit more about the people who are entrusted with our protection.
Well, I mean, I think we're a San Francisco police department that looks like San Francisco. At one point in time, up until the mid-80s or so, there was a residency requirement. That's why, as you said earlier, I'm a fourth-generation San Franciscan, but when I became a cop, you had to live in the city for a year before you were a cop, and a year later, that was found to be unconstitutional to require people to live somewhere where they worked. But we aggressively hire. We just did a big recruiting drive over the holidays. Over almost 6,500 people applied to take the test to become a San Francisco police officer. I like to think, A, because it's a good job, and B, because we're an organization worth joining in a worthwhile cause. So we have men, women, gay, straight, white, black, red, yellow, you name it. We're a mixed bag, and I've often drawn the parallel. We're sort of like the Stanford Band. You know, we may not be as paramilitary as some police departments, but I think we're as good as any.
Hmm. And what percentage of your officers currently live in the city limits?
You know, I don't know that exactly, but I was very refreshed when I went up to one of the recent academy classes and I asked how many people actually lived in the city, and it was over 60% of that academy class. And we are in the middle of a big hire. We'll hire about 1,000 officers over the next 6 years. And I am really, really doing my best to say that if you currently live, work, or go to school in San Francisco, please think about joining the San Francisco Police Department. Mm.
And is there anything that you think of when you think of this actual topic? Because I think it comes up a lot in Oakland, for example, the concerns about who's policing Oakland. Is it people who live in Oakland or not? I'm not sure if San Franciscans have the same question in mind. What's your take on how important it is for a force to come from the place that it is policing?
Well, I think it's better. You don't have to be born and raised in San Francisco, but it's certainly good if you've ever lived in San Francisco or gone to school in San Francisco or worked in San Francisco, because I think it's really, really important that you have done your time in the streets in San Francisco without a police uniform on, if you're really going to have an opinion about how San Francisco should be. When you've never lived in San Francisco and all you do is come in to police San Francisco and live outside San Francisco, it's hard to get a frame of reference where, you know, my kids went to school in San Francisco, I went to school in San Francisco, my nieces and nephews go to school in San Francisco, my mom lives in San Francisco. It matters a great deal to me, for obvious reasons, that San Francisco be a certain way.
And so you mentioned you're increasing the force by 1,000 officers over the next 5 years, you said?
Yeah, it's not an increase. It's a transition.
Okay.
1,000 will have left and 1,000 will have replaced them.
Okay, so we're sort of actually it's going to be a neutral change in the sense that there will be an increase.
We'll be up 300. We're down 300 right now.
Okay.
So we will hire 1,000 to replace the 300 that have left and the 700 that will be leaving over that same time period.
I see. And so what do you see as the opportunity at this time as you bring in a whole new group of police officers? What do you see as the opportunities for change as other officers retire?
You know, it's funny, but I don't think your radio show is long enough to name the amount of opportunities that I see.
We've got some time.
I think we can learn so much from new officers, right? So there should be a complete renaissance, I think, in the police department. Some of the officers that are leaving are absolutely spectacular police officers. I mean, we are going to be losing literally some of the best cops on the planet in the next 6 years. So my task is I need to get them to impart all that experience, all that knowledge to this new group while they're coming in. And at the same time, many of these young officers coming in, they didn't grow up in San Francisco like a lot of these folks that are leaving. So we need to show how it is in San Francisco, right? So some of the things we're doing in the academy is recruit officers are required to spend 4 hours a month in one of the Boys and Girls Clubs. No police duties at all, just with kids in San Francisco. They're also required to match that 4 hours with 4 hours on their own time every month. So every San Francisco police officer will spend at least 8 hours in a Boys and Girls Club or an at-risk youth center in San Francisco, just so they get it, right? We've gotten such positive feedback already from the Boys and Girls Clubs and the kids, just that these officers are in there and they're earnest and they're experiencing the kids just like the kids are experiencing them. It's really critical. Probably the biggest piece that we need to transition is technology. When I came in the department, we didn't even have department-wide email. We now have that. We didn't have an internet-based report writing system. We now have that. We have beta-tested laptops in the field to keep officers outside to increase their efficiency. Right now, we're looking at what kind of smartphone we might be able to get. We have meetings with Kamala Harris' office, the Attorney General, to see how we can get around some of the DOJ rules, if you will, that so far we haven't been able to get a handheld. San Diego had it for a cup of coffee, but they lost it because they couldn't meet those DOJ requirements. Mm-hmm. So, and then the older officers need to learn from the younger officers that there is a smarter, more efficient way to do it where we can Google search our database. I mean, we've made more cases just in the last 6 months using social media. I mean, we made the guy that broke out the windshield on the bus through social media. We've made other cases. We now recently ID'd this guy in the Tenderloin that threw the dog under the car via social media. Again, it's a real true partnership of police and community facilitated with 21st generation technology, and I think the sky's the limit.
And I definitely want to focus a little bit more on the technology aspect in a moment. What else do you think could come of just the turn of the generations in terms of anything you're thinking of in terms of culture of the police department or the style or the philosophy of the policing?
Well, I mean, again, the you've used the phrase a couple times, right? You've used police force a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Once you use force, you're kind of done. Hmm. You know, you use force. It's hard to pull back and dust somebody off and say, okay, are we good now? Let's have a conversation. I'm a big person and let's have the conversation. I'm not a small person. I have not arrested people. I have. But I'm good with everybody that I've ever arrested before because it just got to that. Nothing personal, just doing business, right? Same thing as having the conversation. If before we go hands-on, before you figure somebody is what they might look like, before you have the conversation, take a minute. Take a step back. Something we've done with the mentally ill people in crisis since I become chief. We do not engage the person or even attempt to physically. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's slow down, step back. And to that end, we haven't had to engage a person in crisis with a weapon that's only been a danger to themselves in the time that I've been chief, and we put out that directive.
That does bring up the idea of you're an advocate for using stun guns or tasers or having your officers use those. And I know that that's been a controversial issue that your predecessors have tried to implement and have not been successful at doing. Tell us a little bit more about your thinking in that area.
Sure. So we already have guns, right? So I volunteered to get tased. Because I believe that I should know what it feels like. You will not find me volunteering to be shot. Like I said, we put out this directive where we stand down, conversation, crisis intervention training, and on, to try and get folks that are in crisis, especially with an edged weapon, that's just a danger to themselves, so we don't either do the job for them or provoke them into doing something. Unfortunately, we had an incident on the Embarcadero where a person in crisis seriously attacked and injured a coworker and then walked off and was headed for a populated area. One of our crisis intervention trained officers actually went to engage the person to keep him from going into a crowded area where he might slash at somebody else. He went at her, and unfortunately, she had nothing short of a stick and a gun, and she was forced to shoot the person and use deadly force. Had she had a taser at that exact same time, I would suggest she might be alive. So my suggestion is, and it's pretty much consistent with best practices from think tanks around the country, if you're going to attempt tasers, is that just start with a small group of officers, not wholesale, not the whole police department. So I'm suggesting that our most trained crisis intervention trained officers, which number around 100 right now, would be afforded the taser as part of their toolbox, if you will, so that since we're asking them to be the people to engage people in crisis, give them one more tool, since they also don't want to have to harm somebody, or they wouldn't have signed up to be crisis intervention trained officers. But give them one more tool, because when an officer uses deadly force, they suffer a lot emotionally as well. So if I don't have to have my cops go through it, I'd certainly not to put anybody else through it. And at the same time, have something short of a firearm, which we already have, and give it to the people the most reticent to use it.
So what you're basically saying is that the stun gun or taser would be used in a way to kind of mitigate the harm that you would want to bring on someone in an attempt to stop them when all else fails. So the opposition to that argument is that, you know, the stun gun or the taser is not all that harmless, and mm-hmm. some people are concerned that it actually causes more harm than it's advertised to. What's your response to that concern?
Well, again, I got tased. I'm fine. But again, I'm a healthy person. And that if these crisis intervention trained officers that we're having to intervene are assaulted, particularly by a person with an edged weapon, they have to defend themselves. No police officer signs up to get seriously injured or killed. We're willing to make the ultimate sacrifice on behalf of someone else. But then again, you know, common sense, fight or flight, all that kind of stuff. So if I'm going to be a specialist in that I go in specifically to deal with people that are in crisis who may or may not attack me with an edged weapon, if I had something short of a firearm, it would be nice if I had that option. I would suggest. Now, there is a process prescribed. We're going to be having community meetings, three of them over the next 45 days or so, and then it'll go to the commission for an up or down vote. But I just felt in good conscience that the suspect that was killed at the Cho Chocolate Factory could very well be alive today if the officer that shot him had a taser.
If you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing San Francisco's Police Department with our guests, Police Chief Greg Suhr. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You can also post a comment on KLW.org or on our Facebook page. So when are those hearings? And so
you
we
know,
can post
I
them
apologize.
On our website.
I don't have them handy, but I promise that I will get them to KLW tomorrow morning so that you could advertise them prominently as we come upon them.
Excellent. I guess that the last question on this particular topic is in as a force or trying to move away from the notion of just being a force.
I'll get you there.
how is it that adding more weapons, so to speak, is going to help the police force move closer to the community it's serving than creating more?
Well, I could see
distance.
If we didn't have guns, mm-hmm. your suggestion that we're getting more weapons. I'm not asking for all the officers to be given automatic weapons. I'm not asking for all the officers to be given higher caliber weapons. I'm not asking for bigger bullets. I'm asking for something short of a firearm. So I know that the people that are opposed to this see it as another weapon. I'm not asking for it for all the officers. I'm asking for it for the officers most reticent to use those same officers that we're going to actually call to engage a person in crisis as a specialty. And that we have instances now where, you know, for our SWAT officers, they get additional training and additional weapons. For our gang task force officers, they get additional training and additional weapons. A motorcycle, everybody that you ask to do something specifically gets something else in their toolbox to help them better do their job. And I would suggest that folks that have crisis intervention training who can tell when a person might be going into extreme crisis to the point where they may try to harm someone other than themselves, it's patently unfair not to give those officers something short of a firearm when their only other choice would be to use deadly force.
Hmm. So to switch or pick up on something you just said about assault weapons, given recent events in Connecticut, how is San Francisco looking at the issue of assault weapons?
So I have said, even before Newtown, Connecticut, to reinstitute the assault weapons ban that Senator Feinstein had in place with 10 years, with no expiration date is an absolute must. Right now, we have the strongest gun laws in the United States here in California, but people have cars and they can drive guns in, and we're very strict on what we do here. I know Mayor Lee, God bless him, he just introduced legislation. I know that Supervisor Cohen here from District 10 is a strong proponent of anybody that buys 500 or more rounds of ammunition, that there would be a registry so that we'd know if anybody was stockpiling ammo, outlawing some of our more lethal bullets, shredders and exploding rounds, that sort of thing. But for someone to suggest that there's any place in America for an assault weapon with an extended magazine or a high-capacity magazine is just lost on me. Those are weapons of war designed to kill people. I know people would say, hey, what about the Second Amendment? When the Second Amendment was written, Thomas Jefferson and company loaded one ball at a time in a rifle. These empty out 100 rounds in seconds. It's just there's no place for it on the streets of the United States.
We have an email from Carl in San Francisco, and he asks, is San Francisco using ShotSpotter technology? And if so, how pervasive is it, and what are the inhibiting factors from deploying it more broadly? So first, tell us what ShotSpotter technology is and then whether we're doing it or not.
ShotSpotter technology is great. What it does is it's a listening microphone system that basically can make the distinction between a backfire, a firework, an actual gunshot. We have it set up in many, many places in San Francisco. Certainly, it's heavy in those areas where we have had a lot of gunfire. There's a shot spotter deployed pretty prominently in the Bayview, but not everywhere. And it gives us an indication long before anybody has to call that there's been a gunshot. And what I would suggest is that we can actually expand upon ShotSpotter and do other things like video analytics that would click on, not to have a camera so that Big Brother's watching, but if there's a gunshot, we have technology now that could click on a camera. We could attach that to a license plate reader that might be able to capture a license plate and or the image of a shooter or a car, all triggered by if indeed there's a gunfight. Now, the other piece of the email, what's the limitations? It's money, like everything else. So ShotSpotter, we have it now. There's an ongoing expense, and we're in negotiations with ShotSpotter right now to expand it a little bit more in order to add whatever we can add to it as the community would like to have.
And how long has it been in place?
Well, it's been a place at least for the 2 years that I was at Bayview, because we relied on it heavily there. And there's a ShotSpotter computer dashboard in the lieutenant's office there, watch commander, if you will. And we react to it, and dispatch has one at the 9/11 center, and they respond also.
And what kind of a difference has it made in your ability to solve crimes?
Well, I don't know about solving crimes, but putting us in the right place or in the right area, or like I was talking about, predictive policing. You know, you get an uptick in shots fired, even if they're all misses. That's a neighborhood that we want to be concerned about. And then we've also been able, you can also determine if you get an expert out here from ShotSpotter, they can actually determine the caliber of the weapon that can help to tell us what we're looking for, what we're up against. It's a great system.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation here on City Visions on KLW San Francisco and KLW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're speaking with San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr about San Francisco's Police Department. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KLW.org or on our Facebook page. So let's go to RJ from San Francisco. Welcome to the program. RJ, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I'm wondering what happened to the Occupy San Francisco movement at 101 Market Street. They were there for over a year, and all of a sudden they disappeared. I'm wondering what role the San Francisco Police Department played in that.
Thanks so much, RJ, for your call.
Good evening, RJ. Thank you for your question. When Occupy started in San Francisco, it actually started at 101 Market Street, and that went all the way up until just a couple of weeks ago when they broke up the sidewalk in front of the Federal Reserve Bank. And now Occupy in San Francisco has pretty much taken on the same metamorphosis, if you will, that has been kind of national, and that it's more of a daytime, day-to-day thing rather than a protracted encampment situation, if you will. I know that last year San Francisco was probably the last major city that at some point in time the fire department, public health, if you'll recall, the police department wasn't the lead on Occupy, but the Department of Public Health, Department of Animal Care and Control, fire, DPW, if you will, kind of got to the point where it was becoming a public health hazard, and there wasn't enough consensus, if you will, to get anybody to kind of make it more orderly, and it was affecting a lot of the other people in the neighborhood. So when the 101, when the Justin Herman Plaza encampment was disbanded, it relocated back to the Federal Reserve, where it remained pretty much for the rest of the year until a few weeks ago.
415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go to our next caller, Ted. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you guys?
Well, thanks.
I'm calling as a Bayview business owner and just want to talk to the chief about the fact that, you know, fireworks go off in my neighborhood and lots of police respond, and how that factors into the viability of that ShotSpotter system.
So when the police, senior Bayview officers can usually make the distinction between fireworks and gunfire. However, better to err on the side of caution and respond. The ShotSpotter system itself makes that distinction. So when the watch commander checks the system, the watch commander can actually tell the officers as they respond what they may or may not be responding to per the computer system.
Okay. Well, because what happens usually is that they come around and they ask if we've seen anybody with guns. And so that doesn't quite answer the question, if you don't mind.
Well, I would suggest that you're in the minority, though, in the Bayview. If someone hears anything that might be confused with gunfire and they don't want the police to come around and ask if everybody's okay.
All right, well, that's better than nothing, I guess.
There you go.
All right, thanks so much, Ted, for your call. So I wanted to ask you, as we're looking, a lot of our conversations about looking forward to new technologies and how policing is shifting. What are some legacies about the history of the police department in this city that you're still kind of grappling with as the current police chief, and have been trying to kind of move away from? Are there any things that are still kind of hanging on?
Well, one of the situations that I inherited that's still going, that's more immediate, was when the public defender, Jeff Adachi, suggested that some officers were being less than forthright in some Sixth Street hotels and in the Tenderloin. To that end, I know that the federal building has had an investigation that precedes my administration that I call on regularly so that we can find out what the finding was. Was there inappropriate conduct on the part of the officers? Was there not? I know that since my becoming chief, we've put a tremendous amount of time and effort into making sure that that there's no way that that could even be suggested again. So we've done extensive plainclothes training, ongoing training. Officers are trained now. There's regular plainclothes training. You have to have a minimum amount of seniority. Police reports have to be reviewed by supervisors. Supervisors have to respond. We're even looking at body cameras at this point to go with consent searches. We worked with Mr. Adachi's office to put out a directive to the officers that they are not to use pass keys without a search warrant or without a probation or parole condition or the accompaniment of the desk clerk and or the residents. So there's been a lot accomplished since these allegations that right now, you know, everybody, even police officers, are innocent until proven guilty. But again, erring on the side of caution, because I think the public trust is something that needs to be not only won but maintained. We've gone a long way, and I'd love to be able to close the book on that, and I'd love to get the officers back to work and out from under this cloud that they've been operating under for a couple years.
And are there some other gaps in public trust that you are aware of and that you'd like to address?
We're really only one bad story in the news media or the press away from someone digging up what went on before. I mean, you can do a ton of things. We got 130 kids' jobs last summer. We're in the high schools every day. We're in the Boys and Girls Club. We're doing a lot of things that I think the officers should be commended for. Certainly the two officers in the Bayview that saved the baby the other day. These are all the San Francisco police officers that I know. And unfortunately, we're a 2,000-member operation. Every once in a while, somebody does something like driving through the Broadway tunnel in a luxury roadster that just gives you a black eye, and then everybody goes right back to, well, what about? And I long for the days when we've won the public trust where the public actually says, hey, you know what, that's a one-off. That's not our police department. Our police department's the one that's in the Boys and Girls Club every day.
415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So let's go to our next caller. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, my name's Mark. I'm in San Francisco.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, now, I'm a student at City College, and last semester, I thought I was being harassed by four campus police. I'm not certain they're actually members of the San Francisco Police Department.
They are not. I'm a Brother Ram. I'm a City College guy myself.
I didn't think so. Well, these four police officers probably know just about nothing about what goes on at the City College. And even after I showed them my student ID, decided they needed to handcuff me while I was busy working with some gardening tools out in front of the horticulture department. For some reason, they didn't believe that I was actually volunteering for the horticulture department.
So I'd need to ask if you have a question regarding the San Francisco Police Department.
Where does a person go to complain about constant harassment from these people? They threaten to make my life difficult on the campus, and now it appears they are continuing to harass me every time they see me on campus. I would like to know, where's the best place to go to get them to stop harassing me?
There's a criminal justice program at City College, and I want to be very clear to the listeners. Those are not San Francisco police officers. But you're best to complain to the Criminal Justice Center or the dean about the conduct of any campus police officers.
Okay, thanks so much for your call. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. And let's go to our next caller. And it's Rachel from the Richmond. Welcome to the program. Rachel, are you there?
Hi, actually, my name's Kimberly, yes, and I'm calling from Richmond.
Sorry about that.
Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, no problem. I just wanted to make sure you're talking to me. I used to work for the city and county of San Francisco for the Department of Public Health, and I've worked in mental health services for many years now for a nonprofit in Richmond. And I just wanted to commend you, actually, because I was really comforted and pleased to hear you consistently talk about persons in crisis. And I know that a lot of times with incidents that are in the media or a lot of times public officials can contribute to the stigmatizing of people with mental illness. And I know that often these events include people with mental illness, but not exclusively. And when I was working with the city of San Francisco, I did have some experiences with some of your officers coming to some trainings or conferences and sharing their experiences in crisis intervention. And I had really good feelings about what they had to contribute in that context. And I'm wondering what your department's current relationship is with the city's behavioral health services division and what kind of partnership or cross-training you do now.
So they're actually operative in our curriculum for our CIT. One of our police commissioners, Angela Chan, heard about what's called the Memphis model, and was, I think, pleasantly surprised to find out that, as you suggest, we're way down the road on our crisis intervention models here in San Francisco. And so I know Helena Brooke used to teach our what they call police crisis intervention training, which is now just called crisis intervention training. We have four trainings scheduled for this year. I know that they're still working on the curriculum, and we're hoping to end up eventually having it post-certified so that it's a curriculum that could go up and down the state. And Kimberly, if you want to email me or whatever, I'd love to have you come and say exactly what you just said, because as I was telling Joseph earlier, my officers don't hear it enough when they're doing it right. So I love to bring people around to say, hey, by the way, you know, unsolicited, this is what somebody thinks when we do it right.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. And again, just thank you for using language that's really inclusive. I think that helps with societal perception a great deal.
I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your call. We have an email from another listener named Carl saying, regarding tasers, the chief makes the good point that it would be useful for officers confronted by people with weapons to have a less deadly option at their disposal. But what about situations like demonstrations where people might be exercising their rights to express themselves in a way that is inconvenient to some politician? That politician might be able to apply pressure on the police force to use tasers as a deterrent, where using guns would clearly be inappropriate. What would prevent situations like that from occurring?
It would be simple. You just make a rule that precludes anybody from using a taser in a First Amendment situation. So, I mean, we have a draft policy. It's actually online, Carl, if you'd like to look at it, on the police website, the SFGov police website. And we believe it's as strict a policy as there is in the state, if not the country. Again, we want it to be the only thing available to you short of a firearm. So this isn't, and again, we're only talking about the crisis intervention trained officers that would have it. This isn't going to be something that we're looking to dispense wholesale to officers. We want it to go in with those most reticent to use it for a specific purpose where the only other alternative would be a firearm.
415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 to join our conversation with Police Chief Greg Suhr here on City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And I want to ask you another question that is going to take us in a slightly different direction here, but something you mentioned earlier, which is gang violence. We could do a whole show on this topic, and we have it in the past and probably should do another one in the very near future. But from your perspective, could you distill for us what are some of the major issues confronting the city around gang violence, and what are some of the things that you're hoping to bring from the police department's purview to address the concern?
Well, this one's kind of in my wheelhouse, Joseph. So let me give you some scary numbers. 94% of the homicide victims in San Francisco under the age of 25 didn't graduate from high school. About the same amount of suspects. 82% of the crime in this country is committed by people that didn't graduate from high school. 74% of the prison population didn't graduate from high school. High school graduates live 9 years less. They make 50% less money, and yet even LeBron James does a commercial right now that every 26 seconds somebody drops out of high school. So just in this show, a ton of kids have opted to become victims to those other numbers, right? So we're doing gang intervention in the Mission, where we're actually working with kids and parents to pledge them out of gangs on the proviso they'll graduate from high school. We're in the high schools weekly, pretty much hitting all the high schools now, that we'll work to get summer jobs for any kid that'll take a chance. We just want them to graduate from high school. And then folks that would say to me, hey, I can't believe that you're setting limits on kids that they can only graduate from high school. Well, another statistic is 100% of the people that go to college graduated from high school first. Mm-hmm. So rather than make it hard on a kid and move the goalpost back so far that they can't even imagine getting there, I would suggest that it's small victories, right? Finish freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, get them out of high school, give them positive choices, give them jobs. Because again, I spoke of that peace dividend where we had this little respite from serious fatal gun violence in the last few years. Kids get older and then they get more brazen and then they get to the point where they get challenged to be in the gangs. I'd love to claim this whole generation from high school back, so that we literally, like you said, I want to give you a question that goes in a different direction. How about a question for a kid that graduated from high school that's a different direction? What do you want to do? I joined this job that I have right now as a high school graduate, not a college graduate. I went back later because I got it later, and that happens a lot, you know, unfortunately, to boys before girls. But you can be a police officer, a firefighter, work for Muni. We have 28,000 city employees. Many of those jobs you can have with a high school diploma. But the doors don't start opening until you graduate from high school. Parents need to emphasize to their kids, get up out of bed, go to high school. The people at school will get the kids to the finish line. And if we can get them out of high school, we can get them there. Mayor Lee last year got 5,000 jobs for kids. Every single kid in this city should be able to get themselves a summer job and a reason to go back to school and finish up.
So you speak very eloquently about prevention strategies and strategies that really look at some of the root causes for people joining gangs in the first place. Let's talk about the part that's not so great, which is what to do with those that are with the gang violence at this point. I mean, there's prevention can do a lot, but what else is in your toolkit at this point gang violence.
If anybody knows of something that's going to, I use the phrase jumps off, if somebody knows something's going to happen and you can tell us where it's going to happen, you don't have to put on the snitch jacket or worry about testifying. Just tell us that it's going to happen. We'll put ourselves in the middle of it. It's our job. We're here to put ourselves in harm's way so things don't happen. But we can't do it without the information. We're not there to hear the conversation about who's going to do what at what club or what venue or whatever. But they know us just like we know them. Just tell us to be there.
How would they tell you?
You can call our tip line. I Carlos will get it. I believe it's five. He'll flash it up here for me.
We're doing hand
five,
signals.
515-475-5444.
There we go. We'll make sure to put that on our website. So that's one option. What else?
So again, I mean, you can call 911. You can call 311. You can call your local police station. You could flag down an officer. You could.
How about text?
You could text it. I'd say text it to me, but all of a sudden I get a bunch of wise guy texts. But I mean, you can do a myriad of different things to get the information of the police department. I would suggest 911. It is a 911 call if someone's going to do gang violence. Call 911. You can be anonymous. You can just say it's going to happen, and you can leave it at that, and trust us to go put ourselves in harm's way and maybe save somebody's life.
All right. So we have a slew of calls to get to here at the last 8 or 9 minutes of the program. Let's start with Nick, who's calling from the Tenderloin. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just curious to know about the police officers who have gone through the training on crisis intervention or kind of de-escalation. Are they always partnered with those who have not gone through that?
Not necessarily. They're easily distinguished, though. They'll have a pin on their uniform that actually says CIT on it.
CIT, okay.
And I would encourage you, if you see somebody with such a pin, they are a font of information. Just approach them and you can ask them. They'll have that conversation with you.
Cool.
Thank you so much, Nick, for your call. 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. Let's go to Janet. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, I just want to say that I really appreciate the SFPD because they helped me in a big way a couple of years ago. I had a housemate who had a psychotic break, locked himself in his room and was screaming, yelling, and pounding on the walls, and I didn't know what to do about it and what was going to happen. And I called suicide prevention because I thought he might try to kill himself. He was completely bonkers. And they told me, call the police department. There are people who are trained to deal with exactly this situation, and call and they'll help out. And I was I was kind of worried about it because I thought, oh, you know, maybe they'll come to the door and they need proof that he's crazy and he won't act crazy, or, you know, I didn't know what would happen. But the officers who came were so nice and they were so kind. They ended up having to kick his door in because he wouldn't open it. But they were very, very gentle with him. They took him out. They took him down to San Francisco General where he was put into treatment. And about 2 weeks later, he was able to leave the hospital and able to go back to his own country. And everything worked out really well. So I really thank the San Francisco Police Department for having people who really are trained to deal with exactly what you were talking about, crisis intervention.
Thanks so much for your call, thanks, Janet. And Greg from San Francisco, welcome to the program.
Yeah, please comment on the Kenneth Harding murder video where we watched for a full 2 minutes while he bleeds to death with no gun in the scene. People are saying, where's the gun? And don't let him die, but that's exactly what happened. And just as an additional thing, why is no officer instructed to shoot someone in the knee if that would be as effective as a taser? The shoot to kill is so demonically moronic.
Right. So, Greg, we don't shoot to kill. We shoot not to miss. So if officers are only allowed to fire their weapon if they believe that they're in danger or someone else is in danger of serious injury or death. So to try and shoot an extremity while it's moving is next to impossible, regardless of how it looks on TV or the movie. So they
well,
aim to hit the
Kenneth Harding.
I know. I'll get to that. So Kevin, Kenneth Wade Harding, who was wanted for a homicide out of Seattle at the time, fired upon the officers, and in the foot chase, when the officers shot at him, they hit him in the leg, and when he fell, he shot himself just under the chin. The gun that he, when he fell, flew forward, the officers believed was still under his body. There's videotape of a person picking up the gun that later was turned in, ballistically matched against the bullet that was...
That video. video. That's part of the crime you're implicit in. I place you under citizen's arrest for the murder of Kenneth Hardy.
Okay. I want to go ahead and finish your comment there.
Yeah. So ballistically, the gun matched the gun. There was also a bullet in Kenneth Wade Harding's pocket. The weapon was turned in, the videotape. As it turned out, Kenneth Wade Harding ended up shooting himself.
All right. Thank you so much, Greg, for your call. So in the last couple of minutes, actually, we started talking about technology and we moved away, went far away from that in our conversation. But why don't you tell us a little bit about how the police department has been partnering with technology companies that are, you know, make their home here in the Bay Area to really, really take policing to a new level.
So we actually had a meeting today with another tech company hoping to help us with an app that might go on a handheld phone. The block that we have right now, our data warehouse is up, but not on a mobile device other than a laptop, because we're running into Department of Justice rules as to how, who can access California criminal information on a handheld. To that end, we do have meetings scheduled in the near future with the Attorney General's office to see if we can't get past that. And then we're going to actually suggest that perhaps maybe we in San Diego could beta test what would be the first smartphone with DOJ capability, which to our knowledge right now doesn't even exist in the country. All these companies have been fabulous. Obviously, they have a business interest if they could be the holy grail, because I do think it would be an efficiency. But I can't tell you how forthcoming people have been and want to help and the like. And, you know, Hewlett-Packard gave us a bunch of laptops that we were able to learn a lot from. And Oracle is the basis for our data warehouse, and on and on and on. SF City funds a lot of the jobs that we've been able to get our kids with in the tech sector that interest them past just, you know, heavy lifting jobs for the summer. It's really been nice.
And if there's something, a couple of things on your wish list, technology or otherwise, that you'd like to see come to fruition in your tenure as police chief, what would those be?
You know, I think probably the biggest thing would be the crossover that you spoke to earlier. You know, what do I hope to do generationally? I'd love to have a whole police department, young and old, that were just as good as street cops as they were with technology, because I just think they would be unparalleled, maybe in the world, as far as being able to get it done. And it's going to be tough, because I mean, I'm telling you, we got some of the best cops in the world that are going to be retiring, and we got to get their ability to talk to people to the text versus talk generation, and vice versa. So it's the meshing of the two. But I think that we've already gone a long way towards that.
And what would you say is the biggest thing that's in your way in doing your work on a day-to-day basis?
You know, it's probably just trying to go against the grain of what people would believe used to be. So every time that somebody does something that's unattractive in a police uniform, everybody harkens back to the last bad story. So for me, I think that a little good faith would go a long way, that we're a police department that's made up of people, and that our hearts are in the right place, and we're really trying to be that police department for San Francisco. And more people like Kimberly and the other Janet that called, that's who we want to be. And when something bad happens, it's just because sometimes, but for the grace of God, things happen.
And we'll have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank our guest, San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. And join our guest host, Victoria Thorpe, next Monday as we discuss the marijuana legalization movement here in California. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. For my co-host, Lauren Meltzer, good night and have a great week.